Hi, and welcome to the Verity Love Poetry Podcast. I'm Alice Allen. In this podcast, we interview poets who've been published in the journal and discuss work that's important to them. In this episode, I talked with Philip Hall and Anne Elvey on the theme of eco-poetics. Philip is a poet, reviewer, and essayist working as an editor with Verity Love's Emerging Indigenous Writers Project. Anne is also a poet and managing editor of Plumwood Mountain, a journal of eco-poetry and eco-poetics. To begin with, we discuss definitions. Further into the discussion, we look closely at Bonnie Cassidy's 2014 work, Final Theory, to see how it looks under an eco-poetic lens. Towards the end of the discussion, we talk about the role of poets as activists. We hope you enjoy this chat with Anne and Philip. Start with Philip. You sent through three really interesting passages on what, or how we might define eco poetry. And I like this last one, Jonathan Skinner.
Mm-hmm.
Who is Jonathan Skinner?
He's the editor of the first e-journal of eco poetics in the US.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool. And he says eco critics have made a useful distinction between nature poetry and eco poetry. One focuses apolitically only on the bird, the other considers as well the bulldozer about to destroy the bird's habitat. So think Mary Oliver for nature poetry and Gary Snyder for eco poetry. So what does that bring up for you guys? Is that a pretty good summation? Would you go further than that? Would you disagree?
I think if we're going to use terms like nature poetry and eco-poetry, we need to know what we're talking about and what we understand by the word. So I think it's important to distinguish between the two things. In the Australian context, like nature poetry, you could think like Mark Tredinnick, Diane Fay, you know, which are wonderful poets. But then with eco-poetry, you'd be thinking more of Bonnie Cassidy, John Kinsella, those sorts of people.
And what would be some of the big differences between those two camps, between the nature camp and the eco?
Well, I guess nature poets praise nature, so they're sitting back and in a rather passive way praising what is in front of them. You could argue that that is a type of eco-poetics because it's raising awareness and making people maybe sympathetic towards the natural world and aware of issues. But the other poets, if you like, it's more of an activist poetry, as John Kinsella would probably say. So it's actually poetry which is engaged to change the world, whether that's in the reader or in the way we engage with things and the issues that we are aware of.
Okay.
I probably disagree a bit.
Good. Disagree.
Because I think you're making too strong a distinction. I agree. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily put Mark Tredinnick strictly in a completely nature poetry.
No.
Or nature writing context. He does inherit that genre from North America, and I think North America's stronger in that genre, say, than the UK. The UK has more, like with people like, well, actually, John
Kinsella?
No, the other one.
Oh, Jonathan Skinner.
Skinner is now, I think, at Warwick in the UK. And they've got quite a group around Warwick, I think. But and Harriet Tarlow is in the UK, and she's got quite a strong sense of a kind of eco-poetry that's, you know, often found text, really connected with the landscape and the social and cultural, as well as ecological kind of intermixture. But I don't think any... I think you're right about someone like Diane Fay, but she wouldn't see herself, I think, as an eco-poet, where I suspect Mark Tredinnick does. And he'll talk about an eco-tone in language so that he would be, I think, writing towards a change of culture. So it's not just to praise natural world. Part of it's about a change. I mean, it might be activist in the Kinsella sense, not Tredinnick. I mean, you might have eco-poetry that's activist in a Kinsella sort of sense, or you might have it wanting to change culture at another kind of level, so, or at a kind of imaginative, cultural imaginary kind of level, which might look like nature writing, but it might be a bit different.
Look, I love nature writing. Like, I love Mark Drudenny's poetry. Yeah. I think his poetry centered on that sort of Charles Wright tradition is fantastic.
Yeah. I'm just saying it's not necessarily exactly the same as North American tradition, I think.
Yeah, probably.
But I think you brought up a different issue that's really important for Australian eco-poetry, and that's how it works in a context of decolonisation and colonisation. So I think that makes our context quite different in some ways, though it's similar to Canada, perhaps. Yeah,
well, it should be similar to the whole of North America, shouldn't
it? Yes, it should be, but in terms of the consciousness,
So do you mean in terms of someone like Mary Oliver might be writing a very beautiful poem about wild geese, but not really thinking about the land that those geese live on and how it's been inhabited by certain people and maybe taken from certain other people? Is that...
Well, I don't know. I don't really know what she's thinking. And I don't know her work well enough.
Okay.
I mean, I've read a bit, but I don't know it enough to say that she doesn't do that.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
So I'm not... I kind of don't want to make it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering as we're saying this, like, how useful is it to kind of worry at what is and isn't eco-poetry? Is that just a massive distraction from the work of making it?
I think Philip's right to make a distinction between a certain kind of nature writing and eco-poetry. Like, the distinction he's making, we might disagree on who's practicing what, and I'd want to read them closely to see who's practicing what. But I think the distinction's correct, that there's nature writing in a certain tradition, like Thoreau or something, is about an often a masculinist kind of connection to landscape. But eco-poetry has more concern for what's happening in that landscape because of human intervention and how... So maybe, I mean, some of the precursors are like John Clare, you know.
Yeah, sure.
In the UK. So I think that distinction's right and it's necessary because otherwise we're just... It could just be feel-good that's not...
Yeah.
Shaping, and it can also buy into that romanticised, you know, Earth as woman and the masculine kind of eye or gaze and or relationship to that. So there's a kind of gender critique implicit, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I think it is a good distinction.
It is reminding me of distinction that I only realised when I wrote a review for Poem of Mountain of Rob Wilson's book Free Will in the Clouds, and I wrote the review and sent it through, and then you sent it back to me saying, just take another look at where you've used the words natural world, and it had never twigged with me that I had this unconscious distinction in my mind between the natural world out there, you know, this untouched paradise, and the human world, which ends somewhere around, I don't know, like the metropolitan border of Melbourne or something. And yeah, coming from Canberra, that's pretty shocking, really, that I didn't have that consciousness until you pointed it out.
That's interesting, because you'd find it Borroloola. Yeah, am I saying it right?
Borroloola.
I mean, you can't have that distinction between the human world and the so-called natural world in the sense of how people... What has meaning in people's lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And particularly the way first Australians live in the landscape and the way they understand the landscape and that relationship with the landscape, it's very different.
Yeah, I think something that you were saying last time you were on the podcast was that we have, white Australians tend to have a sense of an untouched Australia. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think personally, in an Australian context, the notion of wilderness is a racist concept. And to see wilderness as untouched landscape is terra nullius. And obviously that is a green divide, and this is where it gets really complicated for eco-poetics, because there's guys like William Lyons, who's a really important eco-critic, and he would argue that if the demands of first Australians is in conflict with the environment, for example in Cape York right now, where we're arguing about wilderness and wild rivers legislation and all that sort of thing, William Lyons would say that the environment needs to be prioritised, because otherwise we're being anthropocentric and we're just doing more damage to the environment. Whereas I think I would always prioritise the rights of First Australians, and that makes me anthropocentric, and it means that there could be some short, medium-term damage to environments, like even in Borroloola and the Gulf of Carpentaria. First Australians can very easily be bought off and silenced by multinationals with trinkets and with royalty payments and with promises and all sorts of things. It's very easy to buy disadvantaged people off, and that can facilitate a lot of damage to the environment. And it also seeds a lot of distrust and problems within the First Australians community, because there are some people who are benefiting through royalties and some people who are not, but all of them suffer, for example, through not being able to fish in the river now because of the high lead content.
Yeah, up in the Kimberley, I mean, I suppose I don't have first-hand knowledge, but my understanding was when they wanted to have that offshore gas thing, it was like Indigenous communities were divided, and there were certainly people who were working with environmental groups on that project to resist that project. So it's not just one voice in Indigenous communities either.
Of course not.
So I think, I mean, I suppose I'd go probably 95% of the way with you about prioritising Indigenous voices, but allowing for that there can be a conversation about the issues.
Yeah.
But it's just very hard, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Because we're, And I don't think it should be decisions made from Melbourne about Cape York or Kimberley or the Gulf region. Yeah,
and I guess in terms of poetry, maybe one of the things that an eco-poetic approach will do that a nature approach won't is to try and grapple with how complicated that is.
Yes.
There's a kind of poetry, and I can't think of a great example, which is probably for the best, but there's a kind of poetry that frustrates me, which is kind of a lament for, you know, this untouched, quote-unquote, place that is about to be destroyed, has been destroyed.
I think I wrote one of those.
I was just thinking, actually, I'm working on one that it does exactly that. I need to change this poem. But yeah... But I mean,
I've got a lament for the Murray.
Yeah, right, okay.
But it's, I would think it picks up on some of the issues. I think lament's valid, but it probably needs to be forward-looking, maybe.
Yeah, well, not all lamentation is sentimental, is it?
No. I mean, and look at Geordie Elbernston's lament after the bushfires on 7th of February, I think it was 2009.
Yeah, those poems are incredible. Yeah,
I mean, she actually took a biblical lament style, but used it. And I mean, that was lament for ecological and, you know, military or, you know, war type of destruction, the biblical lament. And she uses it in this new context and in quite a, I think, you know, it's not just saying it's a natural disaster. It's kind of, I think it's quite subtle how she did it.
And it's not just sentimental, because I guess the sentimentalism, again, places the human, the writer, the I at the centre, being like, oh, poor me, I have to see this. It's so hard to see this for me.
It depends what the lament's for.
Yeah. And I don't think any poets are just eco-poets or nature poets anyway. Like our touchstone poet would have to be Judith Wright.
Right.
And she consciously wrote poems of praise, which I would classify more as nature poetry. And then she also wrote explicitly activist, politically engaged poetry, which I would have thought was eco-poetry. So I don't think any poet is just one or the other. I guess it depends on what you think is the purpose of the writing.
And I think your point about the eye, I mean, some people would not want to have any lyric, any eye poetry in eco-poetry. And one of the points Harriet Tarlow makes in that editorial is the way the I or the we or the you is functioning in a poem is perhaps more to the point, not whether, you know, not saying you can't have it.
Mm.
But yeah. I think, I mean, Michael Farrell is a really interesting poet writing, you know, eco-poetry in a way that's quite different. So I think it spans a whole lot of genres.
Mm. Yeah, well, that kind of answers a question that I was going to try and ask, which is there a certain form or subject or even like a value system that has to be in place for something to fit into eco-poetic category? But I think what we're saying is that it's sort of a continuum.
But probably a value system might be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
A commitment to, you know, I mean, Kinsella's a kind of, I won't say extreme example, but kind of a admirable example in terms of his commitments, in terms of how he relates to land and food and all those things. And there are others who, you know, I mean, Judith Wright, in the end, stopped writing. Whether I don't know if that's a good choice or not, but she was very actively involved as an activist. I mean, for the Great Barrier Reef, and then and for Indigenous question, you know, rights. So I think there is a value system. There's a commitment that the writing is actually a form of activism. I think. Yeah, and it goes, and that entails some sort of commitment to an activist kind of life, whatever that means for the person. I think, anyhow.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think the essential quality of nature poetry is one of praise, and the essential quality of eco poetry for me would be an interrogative tone, and which is what you were basically saying.
Mm.
Which is interesting with some poets when there's a little bit more obscurity. Like, I know John Kinsella has often been criticised as being quite willfully obscure and difficult.
Mm.
There was a review of the Vision of Error, that sextet of activist poems in Verity La, last year or the year before. And the essential theme of the review was that it's ironic that he wants to be an activist, engaged poet, and yet he writes such difficult, obscure lines that it's actually very difficult to understand what he says, therefore be engaged or activated by it. And so then you get this whole idea of, you know, like the essential difference in war poetry, like Wilfred Owen, you know, the difference between Bob Dylan, who can say war is terrible, war is shocking, all of these sorts of things, and then a Wilfred Owen poem, which is extremely accessible to read, but because of the skill and the technique, it really just stays in your head and it just echoes around. You know, the anti-war message is on a completely different level. Whereas with eco-poetry, if it has a lot more obscurity about it, is it going to have that same engagement with a readership? I don't know. Like, I love John Kinsella and things like that. So,
but not all his work's obscure.
No.
It depends. But I don't think obscurity is necessarily a problem. But it is a problem of people learning to read. I mean, a lament poem, a fairly basic kind of lament poem, people can feel like it might not move anything on. Like, it's not necessarily, like, whether it's nice nature writing, that also might, I mean, it might or might not move anything on. I guess it just, I think sometimes we might need to challenge people to engage with so-called difficult poems. I mean, I suppose, like, Michael Farrell's Lyrebird got a lot of... It probably is more one of his more accessible poems in a way, just because it uses the repetition like the Lyrebird, and yet it's much more interesting. I mean, the lines aren't necessarily related to the Lyrebird. You know, they're found... They're sort of not found from other places. They're imagined kind of text, but they reference 19th century explorers and all sorts of things. But it's kind of a... So in that sense, it has that activist kind of interrogative way, but it also mimics the Lyrebird. And it's more, I found it more interesting than most Lyrebird poems. Like, there are heaps of Australian Lyrebird poems, but it's a much more interesting poem in the way it engages. And... I think maybe, yeah, I mean, you mentioned teaching before, that might have been before we started. But yes. I think there needs to be more ways of people learning how to read and not to get put off by a so-called difficult poem. Because how are we going to change our cultural imaginaries unless we're challenged to think differently?
Mm.
So I think that's part of why there are difficult poems. It's to actually, like, I mean, in terms of Indigenous poetry, Lionel Fogarty, you know, he uses the language in a way that makes you, you know, it should be, I don't like the idea of hardwiring, but it should be something that shifts your neurons around a bit when you're reading it.
In this next section of our chat, Anne Phillip and I look closely at Bonnie Cassidy's final theory, which came out in 2014. But if you don't have a copy or if you've never read it before, don't worry, you'll still get plenty out of this section of the podcast.
There was a sequence of this in a John Leonard publication of some young poets before this book came out, and an earlier version of what becomes the ending of the first section really grabbed me, because it seemed to be an imagining of what a post-human future, but loving a post-human future, could be. So it was kind of, so I'll just read the last page of that sequence, that I just thought it was a really interesting kind of, it's odd, you know, in terms of environmental destruction and you know, what science says about, you know, the future of species and of our species and the earth, that you might imagine a future without humans, but that is still hopeful and continuous. But here it goes, if we lay beneath that rubble, we'd see how we were built for ruin, like sand for glass. For now, you are a still. And in some future ocean, our beloved proteins will roll, perhaps finding one another, linked by a theoretical wave, like voices sent through cans and string.
Yeah, I adore that line, like voices sent through cans and string. I hadn't seen that before, until you pointed it out, the idea of, post-human future.
But not just a future where love still has a meaning.
Yeah, because a lot, I feel like when I read this book, I think of it as a little bit like a road trip, a lot like a love story. But yeah, definitely a love story that exists in a kind of space where, I don't know, it's like semi-apocalyptic maybe, or like on the verge of,
But in a really gentle way.
A very gentle apocalypse,
And it's kind of a climate change narrative, but not, but I like that you can't put your finger on what it's doing, that we are in this really complex situation and that we can't control. I mean, we can do better, but there are elements of it we can't control. So I just feel she's captured a lot of that, but it's connected to these places too. So there's Aotearoa New Zealand and there's Antarctica and different places, but yeah, and the she, all the pronouns pretty much are female, I think. It's the main character, at least the main narrative voice seems to be this she, or referent or something.
And there's a lot of lamentation in this, isn't there? Well, this is another good example of lamentation.
Want to read a bit?
Sure. Well, that, you know, on page 16, there's this beautiful lamentation to a world almost that has no birds in it. So the quiet day comes. It glows with us and no one. The west wind bows and flocks the street. Once it brought the rifleman, bush wren, rock wren, Stevens Island wren, papio, hua, saddleback, kakurka. Short-tailed bat, long-tailed bat, who opened a gap and thudded through back first. And then it continues to go on to sort of name this absence of birds and what that might mean in this post-apocalyptic sort of world.
What do you think of the
sections that aren't, so sort of half the book is this road trip,
mm-hmm.
and then there's another kind of interwoven story of a girl who lives underwater, and yeah, it's just kind of moving through this underwater landscape.
Like, this is a poem, I think, that really skillfully uses what Emma's talking about with that obscurity. And it's a good example, I guess, of how obscurity is not always a weakness. Because you are always aware, I think, that there's a real interrogative tone that brings these two plots or those narrative devices sort of together.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I think this is a good example also of eco-poetics, that there, you know, it's not just a lamentation, it's not just a in praise of. There is this real interrogative aspect to it as well, which brings these two narrative plots together. Like Bonnie Cassidy on page 42, she actually says, either poetry or a fracture could restart the river's current, uncomplicate that concrete dam, just as these words cup the old lake, still faintly carved and sunk, and undo its eclipse. So she's even almost explicitly saying what the poetic movement is, or what poetry might be able to contribute to this interrogative venture.
I read it first time in a sitting, and it just takes you along. So maybe it does have that, because you can't, it's not a linear narrative that you're going to sit and read, you know, and know at the end what the story is. Maybe it is part of that shifting the culture, you know, sort of letting your brain or your mind and sort of open to other possibilities or something of ways of being in the world.
Yeah, it's certainly a very open-ended text, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess that's part of that eco-poetic approach as well, of like having an answer, making like definites and everything tied up is like puts you back in that space of I understand, I know, I'm in charge of this situation, and a text like this, you're not in charge, and I don't think any of the speakers or the characters in the poem are really directing it.
No.
And so, yeah, there's just a lot of space and not knowing, and that's uncomfortable maybe for some readers, but to not do that would be like not really honouring the subject.
But just as you were talking, I just went back to thinking of another kind of eco-poetry in terms of form, and that's people not trying to respond to something organic about Earth. So it's not exactly nature writing. It's a kind of trying to find language form for something that's not human language.
Oh, yes. I've read a poem like this once, I think, by a US poet called Brenda Hillman.
Right.
And it's written in the voice of birds who have been caught up in an oil spill. And so, like, what more kind of sad, lament-worthy topic is that? But the way she does it is that she kind of speaks as a bird. And I saw her read it, and she just makes these sounds at the end and starts trilling. And yeah, is that kind of what you mean there?
Well, not just that it might just be the way it's on a page,
right,
too. Yeah, I think that's one way. Or I think some of the found kind of poems can be a bit like that. I can't think of an example at the moment. But I know what you're talking about, because apparently there was a Tasmanian poet who I don't know who it is who did that too with birds,
cool.
Or trying sort of almost finding notation for the birds.
Yeah.
Voice.
Page 44 is another great example of this interrogative tone. Bonnie writes, first we see the starry flags tilted, the birds that exist always elsewhere, in name and abandoned whole, on the wing after hours, having traded off a final pencil descent for the return to buried darkness and rest. You ask me their name, I say one quickly invented. It sits on the wind, no less alive than another, no more than the birds at our feet. First we see the first birds in years, our tires blur into sand. And there's a lot of imagery throughout this in the lamentation of birds as roadkill, as well as this empty sky. There's a real lyricism in the language, like the language, you know, the imagery and the use of sound, like it's a real beauty, a lyricism in the language. But that's almost juxtaposed, and there is a real type therefore of lamentation or praise. But that's almost juxtaposed then with this, a lot of the starkness of what's going on and the absence of birds. And, you know, what does it mean to live in a world where there might be no wild birds? And how that leads you then to ponder, well, what might have changed to have created such a thing where that's almost seen as being normal? And so that feeds into this interrogative sort of tone of lamentation.
Well, there's also the issue of language as construction and as constructing a world, because, you know, you ask it their name, I say one quickly invented. So
they're all invented.
So they're all, well, that's what it seems to be pointing towards, they're all invented, no less alive than another, no more than the birds at our feet. So you move from the word for the bird, the invention of a name for a bird, somehow being related to the birds that it, you know, the death of the bird.
Yeah, I like that.
So there's that kind. I mean, some bits like this are quite approachable. It's as a sequence. It's moves and shifts you. So you will come across a page like that that's very approachable in terms of the, you know, some parts of the meaning being fairly evident, I think. And then it moves on.
Yeah, what you said is really caught beautifully on page 53 in the third stanza. Then in the red loam, a web of burrows gaping open and feathered by the wind, and here a sign, here names the birds, as you wanted. Not as I named it, but rounded and agile, the language still warm. We roll it into our sentences, but it hardly makes a sound. I take it out of the poem and put it back on the ground.
Yeah, that's lovely.
There's also something really interesting going on too, isn't it, with the real sort of almost sparse minimalism of the language, of all that's been left out in terms of it being a narrative poem, and particularly, as you said, Alice, with those two narratives almost running side by side. And there's such a minimalist, sparse style to telling the story, which goes back really nicely to the title, Final Theory, which is that holy grail of science reductionism, that you can reduce everything to a simple mathematical equation that you could put on a coffee cup. And it's that wonderful, you know, that minimalism is caught so nicely in the image of the title, I think.
See, I wouldn't have taken Final Theory in that sense. I've never read it in that science. I can see what you're saying, the universe, looking for a universal theory of everything. But I guess I took it more in that apocalyptic kind of sense. Having read before, because I'd read a bit of the sequence before in a different context, before it had this title on top of it. So I'd seen it as kind of pointing towards more, that kind of, so not exactly end time, eschatological kind of thing, but that kind of almost undoing itself. Well, I think you were saying that too, that it's sort of Final Theory, but it's not.
Yeah, it's kind of like, if there was a Final Theory, it would be like this. It would be kind of sparse. It wouldn't necessarily make linear sense. It wouldn't, there would be all these questions, there would be all this room for doubt and wondering and pondering things.
I find the tone of it, despite the sort of, you've been using the word lament, but the lamentable kind of background of extinctions or, climate change and various, you know, other ecological damage, the tone of it actually is hopeful.
Mm.
Like the actual way the writing has a feeling of hope,
yep,
in the tone of it, which I think is really, I just find that really interesting and probably attractive, yeah, in the writing.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it definitely isn't, you don't get to the end and feel downtrodden or depressed. But I think the hopefulness comes from, it's definitely not from the human perspective in the book.
Mm.
It's like, if there's hope, it's when the humans are removed and they're, like, in that stanza that you read, they're kind of lying under rubble, or their proteins are dissolving into a future sea.
Mm.
Or they take the word and they put it back on the ground. It's when they step back.
Mm. So in a decentering of the human. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
In this last section, we kick off with the question, how much activism do poets, particularly eco-poets, have to be engaged in outside of their writing practice?
The activism, at least, that's out with the bulldozers and right seems to be, well, I would find that really hard. I think to do things like, that are more household oriented, they're not really that activist, because they're not, I mean, they might be, you know, energy related or consumption related and that sort of thing. But I think the writing also has to be seen as a form of activism, but that doesn't take you away from actually being involved. I just think it's a hard thing to decide the balance, or if there's a balance. So I'm not surprised that at the end of her life Judith Wright chose one over the other. I mean, that might have had other reasons too, about her sight or various things, but yeah, or that she might have felt she'd said what she had to say in poetry. I don't know.
Was that whole thing, isn't it? Poetry doesn't change the world.
So. Well, not immediately.
No, that's right.
But how much have you been influenced by poetry?
Well, that exactly, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I think about who I read when I was growing up, like Wordsworth. I mean, obviously. I mean, they're not just nature poets, those 19th century romantics, some of the North American tradition, but I think I think you get influenced by Judith Wright and different people. So does that form your social conscience, or is it other things? I don't want to give up on poetry having some activist
potential. I think you're right.
Yeah, and also isn't there something a little bit activist in just sitting down and writing a poem?
Yeah, and not getting, going out and getting money in other ways.
Yeah, you're not participating in any kind of economy, really. You're doing something that is so counter what you're kind of trained and told to do, which is to participate and produce and consume.
Yeah. What do you think? No.
Well, it's that 1930s thing, isn't it? Like, I was quoting W.H. Auden ironically with Poetry Doesn't Change the World. Like, in the 1930s, there was that real commitment between the arts and the Spanish Civil War and a real explicitly left-wing agenda. And there were poets then, like Cecil Day Lewis and people, who actually thought poetry could change the world in a really explicitly economic way.
Mm.
It actually led to a communist revolution.
Yeah.
And then you've got guys, beautiful poets like William Morris, who wrote News from Nowhere, that communist utopia. And he obviously wrote to change the world.
Mm.
And he believed in the act of reading, the act of imagination, it would change people's values and would lead to that revolution.
Mm.
But then post the 1930s, post World War II, I suppose, there was a lot of pessimism that set in, and which led to people like W.H. Auden to make those sorts of statements.
Mm. But he still wrote.
Exactly. Yeah.
He still wrote.
Well, I think he gave up on the revolution. But
But part of it's about witnessing too.
Yeah.
And I think that's another area of eco-poetry. Part of it's about witnessing, whether that's lament or witnessing in some way.
Yeah. Well, to go back to Marx, like, I don't think poetry is going to change the structure of society, the economics, but poetry, I think, can change the superstructure or contribute to that ideological shift the way you're talking about.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's whether the superstructure has to be changed before the structure or...
And some of your poetry would be a poetry of witness, I'd say.
Yeah, I hope so.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's important to bear witness to things, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, we probably have work to do so that only that it's not just poets reading poets.
Well, I really feel, and I don't know if this is completely misguided, but I really do feel like in the last couple of years, there are a lot of really interesting communities springing up around wanting to read and understand poems that aren't just poets talking to each other. I really believe that. Yeah, it's just an interesting conundrum, isn't it? The whole like obscurity and then sort of needing to have that obscurity and those open-ended texts so that we can reflect the fact that these are problems that don't have easy solutions. And then how do you get a readership kind of in contact with that? So we probably won't come up with the answer today.
I don't think so.